Good morning, everyone. It is 10:01 a.m., Wednesday, March 14, 2018, my oldest niece's birthday. And I call this meeting of the North Dakota Public Service Commission to order. I'm Chairman of the Commission, Randy Christman. With me is Commissioner Brian Crosius and Commissioner Julie Fedorchek. So we have a quorum. I'm going to make kind of almost like opening comments a little bit when we get into scheduling. I want to add some comments. But for now, the only thing I want to point out, with some of the insolvencies we've had in the grain business in recent years, we've urged our staff to get out and try and get to, like, ag producer meetings or elevator meetings or those sort of things. And I rode with last night up to Partial, to United Quality Cooperatives, kind of, it's not their annual meeting, but kind of a grower meeting that they had, and watched our guys give just an excellent demonstration. Didn't take a lot of their time, but got a lot of good points across to those members. And they had a slide presentation as well to kind of help educate those members on what kinds of things are covered by our grain licensing and bonding, what kinds of things aren't, and some of the pitfalls that other egg producers have gotten themselves into that could be avoided. So really good work on behalf of our grain licensing team. Opening comments, Commissioner Crosius?
Not a lot for me. Good morning, everyone. I was mentioning just earlier, I think it is, or I know it is Pride of Dakota Day. Down on, is it the first floor of the Capitol? So, and ground as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, if anyone has time out in the public, I would invite you to come to the Capitol. Should be a good day.
Commissioner Fedorchek.
Does that mean you're having lunch with via all the samples down in Pride of Dakota Day?
I think it's a part of my duty that I familiarize myself with North Dakota economy whenever possible. So, yes.
I hear Dots Pretzels has a new version out. So.
Really?
No, I'm kidding.
We're all on
Darn it.
Oh, you can't mess with perfection. So I don't have any opening comments.
Okay, on our consent agenda, we have six items plus previous meeting minutes. I move approval.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, motion is approved.
Okay, moving on to the regular agenda then. My first item, I move the commission issue the order granting request to discontinue business in Garski Elevator Company, license number 130, Garski, North Dakota. Discontinue business, case number GE-18-84.
Second.
This is a little bit of a complicated one, but not a, I don't think, a major issue. Last year already, on March 28th, Garski Elevator Company filed a request to reduce their license capacity from 566,000 bushels down to just 20,000 bushels. At that time, the facility was sold to Tronson Grain, and last year on March 17th, Tronson filed a grain warehouse license application to operate the warehouse, and that license application was approved effective April 1st of last year. So now that brings us up to now, when Garski has informed us that they will... I forgot a point. Last year, when they discontinued that, they kept that 20,000 bushel capacity because they had some credit sale contracts that needed to be closed out in January of 2018. So that's why they held on to that license, despite selling the facility to Tronson. So now their credit sale contracts have been closed out and the license is no longer needed. On March 1st, we received a request to discontinue business completely at Garski. And I think that completes everything. The staff recommends that the discontinue business be approved.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I will just point out that Garski, for those who aren't familiar, is about 25 miles or so north of Devil's Lake. And if you haven't ever gone up that road north of Devil's Lake, there's not much left at Garskitz at the elevator, but that was a Jewish community years ago at statehood, and there's a kind of a really cool-looking Sons of Jacob Cemetery there right along the east side of the highway. So interesting little point to make sure you drive by sometime.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, RC2. I move the commission approve the 2018 Wilton Phase 4 Shell Lake and Williams County Road 9 Phase 7 AML project and the 2017 Morton County AML project and the 2017-18 sinkhole filling AML project for abandoned mine land reclamation in 2018, and submit the 2018 to 2021 North Dakota Abandoned Mine Lands Simplified Grant application to the Office of Surface Mining to request $2,802,000 in federal funds.
Second.
It's always amazing that a motion like that can contain the word simplified. But on February 26th, we received notice that OSM had allocated the state of North Dakota $2,802,000 for the next AML grant period, which began March 1st of this year. We should have been allocated $3 million this year as a minimum program state, but this amount was reduced 6.6% due to sequestration. The AML division plans the following three AML projects in 2018. The first is our drilling and grouting project, which will be a continuation of work. And it has three sites, by the way. It is a continuation of work begun in 2015 to stabilize collapsing underground coal mines along and beneath North Dakota State Highway 36 near Wilton. The second site is a farmstead about 14 miles north of Parshall. And the third is at two businesses along Williams County Highway 9 near Williston. Reclamation will be accomplished by drilling into the mine workings and pumping pressurized grout into mine voids. This work will entail rotary drilling, casing, pumping grout, and grout testing. Approximately 35,000 feet of rotary drilling, 6,000 feet of casing, and 7,000 cubic yards of grout will be required. The work will be conducted between June and September of this year. The estimated cost of this multiple site project is $1.6 million. The second project is out here in Morton County, northwest of New Salem. And again, it has two sites on this one. The 36-acre project will eliminate about 2,850 feet of dangerous final pit high walls at these two abandoned surface coal mines. So the first one is the Carrick site, includes about 1,600 feet of high walls on 24 acres, and that is approximately 8 miles west and 2.5 miles north of New Salem. The Nils site is about 5 miles west and 2.5 miles north of New Salem. There are about 1,250 feet of high walls on 12 acres. These mine sites have steep high walls that are about 15 to 40 feet high. The high wall at the Carrick site is within 500 feet of a public roadway. The high wall at the Nils site is also about 500 feet from a roadway and about 150 feet from cultivated fields. The proposed reclamation work involves backsloping and backfilling the high walls with earthen material from adjacent spoil piles. About 120,000 cubic yards of spoil material will be needed to be moved to this reclamation process, and the estimated project cost is about $300,000. The third project is sinkhole filling, maintenance, and emergencies, kind of a general generalized project. Some available construction funds, about $100,000, will be used to fill hazardous sinkholes caused by collapse of underground mines outside of the other named projects. Some funds may be used to conduct maintenance work on reclaimed sites. If necessary, some of the funds will also be used for emergency reclamation projects. The administrative portion of this grant covers just this one-year period. The construction period on the projects I named can be extended. We have 3 years to complete them until February 28th of 2021.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I would just add that a lot of times when we look at the mining that currently takes place, the lignite mining in North Dakota, if you go back to what caused these areas to be compromised was room and pillar mining, if I have my history down correctly, that dates back to 1870. So this has been going on a long time, and I believe that was through about the mid-1940s that it occurred. And when you think about the fact that over primary roadways you have these voids underneath, it's a serious situation, and the reclamation folks are doing a really good job with that.
And thank goodness we can never, I think, give kudos enough to those who came before us, who in the 60s and 70s, when science had improved enough that they could do good reclamation and equipment had improved enough that they could do it efficiently, decided that we, at that point, were going to start reclaiming mines as we go, and so we're not creating these situations anymore. And also, thank goodness for the current mine companies who are paying an additional fee for every ton of coal they mine to provide the dollars that we receive these grants from. So, good point.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
And that concludes my portfolio. Commissioner Crashes.
Mr. Chairman, before you move through BK1, I would like to request that we hold that over to the next meeting.
BK1?
Yes.
Okay. We will postpone BK1 until our next meeting.
Thank you.
Commissioner Crashes.
Okay, next up on my agenda, I move the Commission adopt the order on consent agreement and Public Service Commission, Wagner Construction Incorporated, Damage Prevention Enforcement, case number PU-17-457, case number PU-17-458, and case number PU-17-459.
Second.
Okay, bear with me. There are three different cases, but obviously all the same company. So on November 8th, 2017, the Commission received three North Dakota one-call complaints from MDU, Montana Dakota Utilities, alleging violations by Wagner Construction Incorporated of North Dakota Century Code 49-23 one-call excavation notice system. On November 15th, 2017, the Commission sent three letters to Wagner, each letter enclosing a one-call complaint. On December 27th, 2017, Wagner responded to those three complaints, and on February 26th, 2018, the Public Service Commission advocacy staff and Wagner filed a consent agreement for the resolution of the three complaints mentioned. Wagner Construction, he is authorized to do business in North Dakota, but their offices are located in International Falls, Minnesota. So on the first case, it occurred on October 6th of 2017. That would be 17-457. Wagner, during the construction process or the excavation process, hit and damaged a 3/4-inch polyethylene natural gas service line. It interrupted service to one customer in Arnagard, North Dakota, and the estimated damage was approximately $568. On August, then going back to August 16th, 2017, in 17-458, Wagner hit a 2-inch polyethylene natural gas service line. That interrupted gas service to 30 customers, also in Arnagard. And at the time, Wagner was installing a water main, which was also the case in the first complaint. Damages in that case were just over $6,900. Then on August 24th, going back to 2016, in case number 17-459, Wagner was again out excavating and hit and damaged a 6-inch steel natural gas distribution main interrupting gas service to 25 homes in Tioga, North Dakota. At the time, they were installing a sewer main. And damage costs at that point in time were estimated at over $27,000. So, you know, obviously they had a pretty rough go of it, and they did have a past history as well. And in the past cases, it was a failure to maintain markings in two instances. They were actually fined $3,500 each in both of those. In another past case, it was failure to conduct excavation in a careful and prudent manner. They hit a power line when they were digging and reaching across, and that was dismissed due to mechanical failure of what I believe was a backhoe. But in two of these cases that I mentioned that they are currently facing fines for, they did not conduct excavation in a careful and prudent manner. And the other two, they failed to maintain the markings during the construction process or the excavation process. So, in case number 17-457, the fine is $500. In case number 17-458, the proposed fine is $1,100 and $5,400 in case number PU-17-459 for a total of $7,000. That would be payable to the North Dakota Public Service Commission within 10 business days of service of this order. And having considered this matter, the commission finds a consent agreement filed on February 26, 2018 is just and reasonable.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Just like to point out one more thing that I just noticed at the end of my notes. We're rapidly approaching spring construction season. And even though right now we're seeing highs around 35, 40 degrees, the frost is still on the ground, things are going to change rapidly. And April is safe digging month. We promote that not only as a commission, but it's promoted by North Dakota One Call. And just incredibly important that operators are taking the proper steps to call in tickets, to maintain markings, to make sure the staff that is doing the excavation is properly trained. Because when you're talking about hitting a natural gas service main, or even a service line going to a residential home, these are serious instances where someone could be seriously hurt or even killed in the process of excavating. So it's not something to take lightly. Public safety, both for the excavator who's working on the end of or working the backhoe, or the public in proximity to the work, you just cannot put a price tag on safety. And I would encourage all, as we enter the new construction season, to take the necessary steps, and frankly, I've visited with staff, and for repeat violators, are the amounts enough? And when you have someone who is a repeat offender, I want to take a much harder look in terms of the dollar amount of the fines.
Is there any further discussion?
Just to echo what Commissioner Krosh has said about the two steps, the first step for safe digging is calling before you dig to make sure that the infrastructure is properly marked so you know what you're dealing with. And then the second part is digging with caution. And in the law, it refers to it as a careful and prudent manner. And that often is a training component to that, that the people operating know when to use the backhoe and when to get out and do it by hand and shovel and expose the infrastructure that's down there in a careful and prudent manner. So those two steps are really the keys, and I think that we've found that the second step is the one that, really results in can result in some serious damages, and it is sometimes overlooked. People think, oh, we know where it is. We're just going to go ahead and use the big equipment. And you really need to take the extra time to expose that infrastructure if you have any doubt. And sometimes that means doing that by hand in order to do it carefully and prudently. So really want to encourage the folks out there to take the extra time to do this right and to avoid A, the damaging of the infrastructure, and B, the damaging to their own health and welfare and to the health and welfare to the people that they're working around.
That's a great point. Hand digging is required within 24 inches of the center line. So they have to get out, and do it. And sometimes it's not convenient, but exactly right. It's about public safety.
Is there any further discussion? Since seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
I move the commission approve the 2017 rate update in Montana Dakota Utilities Company, a division of MDU Resources Group Incorporated, transmission facility cost recovery, rates, case number PU-17-468.
Second.
On November 21st, 2017, Montana Dakota Utilities filed an application to update its transmission facility cost recovery rates. The TCR provides a mechanism for MDU to account for and recover its MISO and SPP revenue and expenses net of any revenues received. On November 29th, 2017, the Commission issued a notice of opportunity for this case. As of the date of this memo, which is actually back on February 28th, so we can probably scratch that, no request for hearing was received. The result of the proposed change in the transmission cost recovery rider for the average residential customer using 894 kilowatt hours would be an increase of 99 cents per month, and advocacy staff did review the filing and underlying assumptions and calculations and believes that the assumptions and calculations are appropriate. And both the MISO and SPP tariffs are pass-through costs to North Dakota ratepayers. They're approved by FERC. The utility does have the opportunity to weigh in on those or accept those, and we always trust that they're fighting on behalf of North Dakota ratepayers.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Just to add to that as well, this is an area where there isn't a lot of sunshine into the process of how those tariffs are set. Well, I shouldn't say how they're set, but there's just a lot that goes on behind closed doors and behind the scenes on the setting of these tariffs. And ultimately, it's done publicly through FERC. But MISO is in the process of rewriting some of its cost allocation formulas for a certain project. Jerry Lehan and I are working on that pretty carefully with other states in our area. This is a process that takes years. This process will probably, it started last year and it goes through till September, I think, is when MISO plans to file its new formula or tariff. And it involves all the OMS states, so the commissioners in all the states in MISO, as well as all of their stakeholder groups. And it's really long and it's really involved, and our influence is dispersed throughout that whole territory amongst all those stakeholders. So it's a give and a take, and you don't get everything you want. But ultimately, you know, it's important that we have the resources like Jerry and the resources in our budget to be engaged at that level, because once it gets approved and FERC approves it, like Brian just said, these are pass-through costs. So we really have to make sure that the formulas and the way they're going about setting these rates is fair to our customers. And that's really what Jerry and I are really 100% focused on, is how some of these formulas are being considered and approached to allocate costs for new transmission projects that are being built to get a lot of renewable energy out of places like the Dakotas and into other states. Who's paying for that? And is it, are those costs being fairly allocated to our customers in the proposals? So it's not something that's really easy to communicate or talk about to customers, and it be, because it's A, it's long, it's a long process, and B, it's technical and complicated, but it is something that we absolutely have to have resources in which to engage on. So thank you, Jerry.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, and my last item. I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in the captioned Montana Dakota Utilities Company, a division of MDU Resources Group Incorporated, generation resource cost recovery and renewable resource cost adjustment, tariff and rates, case numbers PU-17-469 and PU-18-82.
Second.
On November 27th, 2017, in case number PU-17-469, Montana Dakota Utilities Company, Division of MDU Resources Incorporated, filed a change to the tariff language and an annual rate update to its generation resource cost recovery rider. The rate change includes updated expenses and a true-up amount related to MDU's Lewis and Clark RICE units. On February 23rd, I'm going to back up, actually, on December 20th, 2017, the commission issued a notice of opportunity for hearing that provided until February 3rd, 2018, for receiving written comments and hearing requests. No response was received. On February 23rd, 2018, MDU filed an update to reduce its GRRR in accordance with Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. So what this boils down to for this first part that I'm talking about related to 17-469 is the effect on a typical bill for a residential customer without electric space heating using 894 kilowatt hours per month would be a decrease of approximately 30 cents or of 30 cents per month. Also then, on February 23rd, 2018, in case number PU-18-82, MDU filed an update to its renewable resource cost adjustment rate 55. The update includes adjustments related to the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 and updated expenses with a true-up amount related to the Thunder Spirit, Cedar Hills, and Diamond Willow wind projects. And again, the average or the effect for a typical residential customer, the effect to their bill, again, without space heating involved, using 894 kilowatt hours per month would be a decrease of 31 cents per month. So in the first case, 30 cents, and the second case, 31 cents, for a total of 61 cents. Those interested are invited to comment on the application in writing. Persons desiring a hearing must file a written request identifying their interest in the proceeding and the reasons for requesting a hearing. Comments and requests for hearing must be received by April 6, 2018. If deemed appropriate, the Commission can determine the matter without a hearing. For more information, contact the Public Service Commission here at the State Capitol in Bismarck at 701-328-2400. And this is just another example of what's occurring with utility rates as a result of the new tax reform that came out of Washington recently. And there's so many different moving parts, and I've stated that and talked about that, but there's so many moving parts, whether it's with the deferred tax payments, whether it's the top bracket moving from 35% to 21%. Again, we've talked about that a lot. There's certainly more to come. These are just two components in the overall picture, if you will, in terms of the type of savings and relief that utility payers will actually experience. So we have other components that that we're working on, some primary components related to just rates in general. And but these, again, are two pieces of underlying pieces as a part of all of that.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order in Senex Pipeline LLC, 10-inch refined fuels pipeline, Williams Montreal Ward Counties, citing application case number PU-17-97.
Second.
Mr. Chairman, if I might also ask at this point, sorry, with the motion on the table, to move JF4 up to JF2 to consider immediately after this first pipeline.
Without objection, we will move item number JF4 immediately after JF1.
Thank you. So Senex, back to this this motion. Senex filed on March 2nd of 2017 an application for a corridor compatibility route permit for this nearly 150 miles of 10-inch diameter pipeline and associated facilities for the transmission of refined petroleum products. The Commission held the hearings on July 24th and July 25th on this matter and to gather input from the public. A little more about the project. This is an 8-inch pipeline for the they currently own an 8-inch and operate an 8-inch pipeline for the transport of refined petroleum from the oil refinery in Laurel, Montana to Fargo, North Dakota. The new pipeline will replace the existing 8-inch pipeline between Sydney and Minot with a 10-inch pipeline. They've upgraded some of the other segments of the pipeline previously, so I think the pipeline will be, once it is constructed, it'll be a new pipeline from Laurel all the way to Minot. The total distance of the pipeline replacement is approximately 181 miles, of which just about 150 miles is in North Dakota, Williams, Montreal, and Ward counties. The pipeline will transport approximately 38,000 barrels of refined fuels per day, but will have maximum capacity of 60,000 barrels per day. Senex testified that the design, construction, and operation of the pipeline will be in accordance with the U.S. DOT regulations governing transportation of hazardous liquids by pipeline. The total cost of the project is approximately $115 million. In applying to the commission, the company consulted with 21 different state, federal, and local agencies and has received responses from a wide variety of those agencies. They also contacted local county zoning authorities and have heard back from them and have testified that they will comply with all the requirements of the local authorities as well. There is really six or seven key issues that came up in this project throughout the hearing process. First of all, regarding cultural resources, Senex testified that 38 cultural resource sites were identified in their field surveys, and they've been in consult with the State Historic Preservation Officer about that. On December 22nd of 2017, the State SHPO identified four sites that the project should avoid, and one of those sites that should have fencing and archaeological monitoring, and also found that the cultural resources unanticipated discovery and monitoring plan was appropriate. And they basically said that if the construction is done as planned, it should not provide any significant impact to the sites that have been identified, and Senex has pledged to follow those procedures. The second issue was related to the Dakota skipper habitat. Dakota skipper is an endangered species. It's protected, and those are avoidance areas. There were 17 areas of potential Dakota skipper habitat that were delineated within the study area. Senex testified it has adopted avoidance and mitigation strategies to avoid direct impacts with the species. Some of those will be they moved the route, and then they've also reduced the construction right-of-way and are providing a barrier around some of the areas where it gets the closest to that potential habitat. So they have effectively mitigated that avoidance area or exclusion area. The third area is related to the Haugen Waterfall Protection Area. This is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Waterfall Protection Area. The company has an easement through that area that they received an existing right-of-way prior to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service receiving the title to this property for that Haugen Waterfall Protection Area. So the company has previous right to that right-of-way, and they testify that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has not objected to them going back through there and reconstructing through a crossing through that area. The fourth area related to the Minot Wellhead Protection Area, there is a portion of the pipeline would be constructed within this wellhead protection area associated with the city of Minot. It could not be avoided because the CHS Minot Terminal is located within that wellhead protection area. Senex testified that the city of Minot has not objected to the route, has indicated that the terminus for the proposed pipeline will be outside of the wellhead protection zone. And so there, we have find with this order that there's no reasonable alternative to the proposed route through this avoidance area. The fifth issue was related to geological instability, areas that are geologically unstable. Those are also avoidance areas. There were three of those areas present in this route, and Senex stated that avoiding these areas would require crossing similar geographically unstable areas. So there really was no alternative to avoiding them entirely. Alternatively, what the company has done in consultation with us during several work sessions, they've consulted with some geotechnical companies that have expertise in construction through there for the best practices and have developed a best practice method that they've filed with us and have agreed to follow for the construction that should minimize erosion through those areas. The sixth area is related to inhabited residences within 500 feet of the pipeline. There is two inhabited residences within 500 feet of the pipeline, and they have obtained waivers from these owners. So that effectively mitigates that issue as well. In terms of other areas of interest, the major water bodies crossed by the project include the Missouri River in Montana. They have received the Corps permit for that crossing. The Little Muddy River, White Earth River, and the Little River, and an upstream main pipeline valve and downstream main pipeline valve will be located on each of the crossings. Senex also testified that it will bore at a minimum depth of 20 feet below the bed at the Shell and Beaver Creeks, the Little Muddy Creek, White Earth, and Little Knife Rivers in North Dakota. So those major river crossings will be bored minimum depth of 20 feet below the bed. Other measures to minimize impact, Senex testified that it will have a comprehensive leak detection and monitoring system installed and operational on the entire line. They testified that emergency response trained personnel and equipment will be located in Glendive, Montana, Newtown, Watford City, and Minot, North Dakota, and they are a member of the Sakakawea Area Spill Response and Williston Basin Oil Spill Cooperative. They will participate in the North Dakota One Call Notification System. And they've agreed to a number of steps to mitigate the impact, additional steps to mitigate impact that are spelled out in the certification relating to order provisions and the tree and shrub mitigation plan. The pipeline company has not received access to survey the entire route. They have easements. Last we heard, they have easements on 74% of the route. And so they are not allowed, per this order, to construct on any of the areas where they don't have easements or have not received the approval to survey yet. And they have to receive that approval, conduct the surveys, file those surveys with our office, both as they pertain to the cultural resources and the biological and wetland resources, and receive approval from our office to proceed on the areas that are related to the environmental issues. And then in the areas related to cultural resources, they have to receive documentation from the North Dakota SHPO indicating concurrence that no historical properties or sites will be affected. And they have to do that prior to beginning construction on any of those sites. They also agree that prior to commencing construction of any portion of the proposed project, Senex shall obtain all necessary licenses and permits for construction of the portion and provide copies to the commission prior to construction of that portion. So with those items in order, I think that we have concluded our work on this project, and I'm ready to approve this project. It is basically a refresh of infrastructure that was constructed in the 1950s, provides refined fuels to serve North Dakota customers. It's an important line that is critical infrastructure for our state and for our economy, and I think we've done all the proper review on this, and in order to show that they can build this line with minimal impact to the people and to the environment. And once completed, it should be a line that is safer and can operate for many, many years into the future on behalf of the company and the citizens that receive products from it.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I would just add that it was a what I feel a very thorough process going through the material. It was certainly took a significant amount of time, but I'm very comfortable with the steps that have been taken and the steps that they will continue to take. And one thing about when we're talking about pipeline safety, we'll talk about safe digging, for example. That's a part of pipeline safety. But also the leak detection and spill response mechanisms that are in place were very important during these particular discussions to make sure that was intact. And perhaps one of the most important things to me when we're talking about pipeline safety, it's about replacing aging infrastructure and putting new high-tech lines in the ground that greatly minimize the risk for a spill to occur. That's incredibly important when we're talking about safety. It really starts with the type of infrastructure that's in the ground in so many ways. So that was, that's just an important point that I wanted to make. And then just it was when you're working with a company that's a farmer cooperative, they certainly understand landowner interests, landowner concerns. They have a lot at stake. They're not just building a pipeline, but they have to serve this very same audience. And even though this product is moving from Montana, it's crossing North Dakota, eventually making its way to the valley in terms of refined fuels, particularly diesel. It's fitting that a good percentage of the product is serving our agricultural community and industry in the Red River Valley itself.
One more comment that I failed to mention earlier is there was two interveners on this project. The Laborers District Council of Minnesota and North Dakota intervened because they're interested in supporting pipelines and making sure that the pipelines are done with local labor and with high-skilled labor, and that was really what they brought to the table. And then there was another group of folks that intervened with one attorney, seven or so different landowners that also intervened. And my understanding is the company's conversations with the landowners in that particular group is ongoing. We did hear directly from other landowners who had issues with the pipe at some of the hearings, and to the extent we were able, we brought those up in several work sessions and followed through on the concerns, and a number of those issues were addressed to the satisfaction of those landowners, and some of them are still under consideration and discussion. So again, it's important for folks to come. We do listen, and we do make every attempt to address the concerns through our permitting process when we're able.
Is there any further discussion?
I just want to point out I recused myself from this case many months ago, so I'll not be voting on this item nor the next item on the agenda, which is JF4.
Is there any further discussion? Since seeing none, I'll proceed with the roll call vote at this point. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Aye.
Commissioner Krosius.
Aye.
The motion has been approved.
Thank you, Darrell. My second motion then will be JF4. I move the Commission execute a contract with Wank Associates Incorporated for construction inspection services in Senex Pipeline LLC 10-inch refined fuels pipeline, Williams County, Williams, Montreal, Ward County, citing application case number PU-17-97.
Second.
This is just the construction inspection contract to follow the item that we just approved. We normally approve these on consent, but since consent happens before the regular, we didn't want to approve this prior to knowing whether or not the motion for the pipeline permit would be approved. So this is just a routine construction inspection project contract that allows the commission to have the third-party construction inspectors out there on the ground and running as soon as construction begins.
Yep. And again, to echo some of the earlier thoughts, incredibly important that this is, you have those sets of eyes out there that are looking at the project before it's actually covered up and placed into service.
We have a motion, a second. Is there any further discussion? Since none, I'll again proceed with the roll call vote. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Aye.
Commissioner Krosius.
Aye.
The motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. Moving on to JF2, I move the Commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order in Arrow Field Services LLC, Arrow Bear Den Gas Processing Plant 2, McKenzie Siting Application Case Number PU-17-397.
Second.
On November 1st, Arrow Field Services filed with North Dakota PSC an application for a certificate of site compatibility for the Arrow Bear Den Gas Processing Plant 2. On February 15th, the Commission held a hearing on this matter. The proposed plant will consist of one cryogenic turbo expander unit with a capacity to process 120 million standard cubic feet of natural gas per day to produce natural gas liquids and residue gas. Arrow owns a nearly 73-acre parcel located about 7.5 miles southeast of Watford City, and the plant will occupy about 50 acres of that parcel. The remaining acres are already occupied by Arrow Bear Den Gas Processing Plant 1, which is a 30 million cubic feet per day gas processor that is owned and operated by Arrow. The NGLs and residue gas from this plant will be transported from the plant through existing pipelines and by truck. The plant infrastructure will include underground piping, above-ground piping, and above-ground gas processing equipment and systems. The estimated cost of the plant, the plant number 2, is $136 million. Arrow conducted all of the environmental analysis and cultural field studies required. They testified that the surveys did not record any exclusion areas within the study area and also did not record any avoidance areas within the study area. Arrow's Class 3 Cultural Resource Survey did not identify any new or previously recorded cultural resources within the survey area, and they provided a SHPO concurrence to us that no significant sites will be affected by this project. One of the key issues on any sort of gas processing facility is safety, and Arrow will continue to coordinate. They already are coordinating because they have an existing facility there. They'll continue to coordinate with local authorities and emergency response managers in that area. And they have updated their plans for the Plant 2 to be equipped for to address any emergency issues related to construction and operation of this facility. They testified that they will perform pressure and function testing before putting the new facilities into service and will comply with all applicable safety laws and standards. There was one person at the hearing, well, two. There was the laborers that attended and testified in favor of the project, again, from the standpoint of being in support of new infrastructure development and the jobs that it creates, and advocating for the hiring of local labor. And then there was one landowner who also participated, their neighboring landowner, and they participated in the hearing and expressed some concerns with the lack of coordination with the company prior to that point. The company acknowledged that and said that they were going to be moving forward with more in-depth conversations with that neighbor and all the other adjacent landowners to mitigate as best as possible any of their concerns. So with that in order and the additional safety discussions, I think that this project meets the requirements for its permit.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
There's an incredible amount of activity in western North Dakota right now related to natural gas capture and processing. And when you look at the new target that's coming up in Q4 of 2018, which is moving the flaring percentage from 85% to 88% in terms of the requirement, this, along with other projects that are either have been approved or are in the process, will help move in the right direction. But there are a lot of really interesting dynamics in play, and one includes just the fact that the oil-gas ratio continues to increase dramatically just due to the nature of the Bakken. Once the rock, the shale, the pressure point drops to a certain stage, a certain level, then more gas is released. So even though oil production is falling, gas production from a volume standpoint, while not necessarily increasing, but as a percentage in terms of the oil-gas ratio, that expands and grows. So it's a good problem to have, but it's also a problem that has to be addressed. And processing plants like this require a lot of supporting infrastructure. So it's not typically just the plant, but it's everything else that goes along with it in terms of gathering lines. Those aren't jurisdictional to the Public Service Commission, but still you're going to see a lot of infrastructure development and activity continue in western North Dakota to not only capture the gas, but to make sure that the flaring percentages and requirements are met.
One other quick thing that I forgot to mention that I found interesting in the hearing was the facility will mostly managed gas that comes off of the tribal lands from Fort Berthold. And it's about a 30-mile distance, I believe, Lawrence, you can correct me if I'm wrong, from a pipe that they're transporting from the reservation to this facility. And we asked, you know, why not just build the facility on the reservation and locate it there, closer to where the gas is being gathered? And the response was revealing to me. It's something I hadn't realized before, but it's a lot more expensive and dangerous to transport the gas once it's been refined and has to be kept at a high, the NGLs and everything else at a high pressure. And so it's easier to transport the raw gas, process it, and then transport the finished product through those high-pressure lines. And so locating near the lines is the most efficient, and that's why you're seeing a lot of these facilities sort of springing up on Gas Row, which they're calling it, which is near the WBI line and the northern border lines. That's where a lot of these facilities are being located, and that's why.
I was trying to remember that term, Gas Row.
Gas Row. Yeah.
Right, and I kept thinking, okay, is it gas plant corridor? Is it? that was really interesting, and you always learn something new that actually fits in well with just the overall inspection process. So
Since I didn't get to speak during the previous motion, I'm going to kind of combine these two things and, as chairman, just brag on this commission and our team a little bit. This is a case, while there was an initial application that was sent back for further refinement by our staff, we actually got the application that we used in December on this. It's barely over 3 months that this whole thing has been processed and moved forward. And a big part of why we're able to move so fast, because of not our schedule so much, but other players' schedules. There was a meeting that I wasn't intending to be at, but I know you two were both participating, and by canceling out on one day of that meeting, we were able to move this up about 5 weeks. Had you two not been willing to do that, we would not have even had the hearing on this yet. Now they'll be able to move forth. Now, in combining these two projects, an important pipeline, an important gas processing plant, in the last hour, we've approved two projects that are going to continue taking trucks off the road and reducing traffic up there, enhancing safety, reducing flaring. It is over $250 million in economic activity for the state with just these two projects, and we're further enhancing America's energy independence. Quite a day for this commission. Thanks to our staff and to you guys.
Is there any further discussion?
And we're just getting started.
Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. My last motion, I move the commission issue a notice of rescheduled hearing, rescheduling the public hearing scheduled for March 6th to April 12th of 2018 in One Oak Rockies Midstream LLC, Cherry Creek Pipeline, McKenzie and William Counties siting application, case number PU-17-483.
Second.
So this is a hearing that we were supposed to have last week, Monday, or Tuesday, and we had to reschedule it due to the blizzard that really came through most of the western and central North Dakota. And so we did reschedule that for April 12th at 9 a.m. Central Time at the Ernie French Center, NDSU Williston Research Extension Center in Williston. And we will go through this permit application there. It is a application for a route permit, a site compatibility route permit, for about approximately 45 miles of 12-inch pipeline existing already, so it's a conversion in McKenzie and Williams County, North Dakota, and One Oak is proposing to convert the existing pipeline from natural gas gathering to transmission pipeline capable of transporting 50,000 barrels per day of natural gas liquids, again, to provide additional efficiencies to the gathering, capturing, and processing of the natural gas in western North Dakota.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
We try to move these things along as quickly as we can and still do it prudently and thoroughly, but we can't change the weather.
That concludes my portfolio, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any
further,
is there any further discussion? Since none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now that concludes my portfolio.
I thought maybe I should weigh in. I didn't quite know what to do.
I lost track of my announcements here, so just give me a second. Okay, today, this afternoon, at 1:30, we have an informal hearing on a complaint regarding Quest Corporation. That's case number PU-15-677. On March 21st, next Wednesday, we once had scheduled a formal hearing on NSP, Advanced Determination of Prudence on a Wind Farm. That's case number PU-17-372. That is postponed. We've now are using that day, again, Wednesday, March 21st, although it's at 10 a.m. Central Time. We'll be having a formal hearing at the High Plains Cultural Center in Kildare, North Dakota, on the Bear Creek Gas Plant Expansion Project. That's a One Oak project, case number PU-18-21. Then moving out, our next meeting date, instead of Wednesday the 28th, it will be Thursday, March 29th, but at 10 o'clock as normal. And I'm just going to jump beyond that to a couple things that I think are important enough to go out more than 2 weeks and start getting on people's calendars. On Tuesday, April 3rd and Thursday, April 5th, we will have public input sessions on Otter Tail Power's 2017 electric rate increase case. That's PU-17-398. We have traditionally done those through the IVAN network, through the interactive video. And we will do that again on Tuesday the 3rd at 5 p.m. And the interactive video sites, besides here on the 12th floor of the Capitol, are Devil's Lake at Lake Region State College, Jamestown at James Valley Career and Tech Center, Washburn at the high school, Wahpeton at the State College of Science, and Botineau at Dakota College at Botineau. And you can check with our office, call in, or look on the internet if someone is looking for the exact details. And then the second public input session, these are not required by law, but we've traditionally held two of them. We're going to do something new. The IVAN network is very difficult to schedule because of the conflicts that the colleges have to get some daytime scheduling. So we are going to do a public input session on the 5th at noon Central Time using a web conferencing system. We're going to try this for the first time. It will allow anyone interested in participating to join from anywhere where they have a computer or a telephone and a computer with internet access. If they have a camera on it, they can get all the more out of it. There also be the option to just call in by phone. We're excited to try this technology in a public input session. In a public input session, it'll allow people to participate from home or from work or really anywhere without going to those IVAN sites. The information to join our session is at our website, www.psc.nd.gov, and under Hot Topics, go to the public input link. So looking forward to doing that. And then just one more thing, Tuesday, April 10th, we will have a formal hearing at Teddy's Residential Suites in Watford City on a Hess project, the Keene Oil Gathering System conversion. That is a conversion I want to emphasize. That's case number PU-18-24. That concludes my announcements. We will stand in recess, take some questions from the press, and then when those are concluded, we'll reconvene about 10 minutes later for the administrative portion of our meeting.
I have a question on the pipeline that you approved. Mm-hmm. Do you know how much of it was not surveyed?
In terms of an actual distance or
percentage or just...
Well, we know what percentage, there were 74% of the line that had easements. I don't know that we got a breakdown of how much of the remaining hadn't been surveyed. I don't think we do. Pat's shaking his head. So the bottom line is it has to, Pat Fon, it has to be whatever hasn't been surveyed is required to be surveyed prior, surveyed, and all the studies filed and the approvals gained and given to us, and then we give them the go-ahead prior to constructing those spots.
But they can construct other portions.
They can construct other portions. The portions that they have surveyed and received approval from they can begin constructing on.
What is their target timeline to have the project finished, Gina?
You know, that's been hard to figure out. Pat, do you have any thoughts on that? They haven't been real clear.
I can tell you what they said in the application.
Yeah, but I think that's way already passed.
Changed.
Yeah. You might want to just give the company a call for more clarity on that question.
Do you anticipate that eminent domain is going to be used for this pipeline?
Well, we don't have any involvement in eminent domain at all. They based on what is happening, they seem to be in good faith negotiations with all of the parties that haven't issued and provided an easement. So I always hope that that's the absolute last resort and that they're able to work out an agreement voluntarily with all those landowners.
Right. Yeah, you would certainly hope not, but that's outside of our control.
May I ask why Commissioner Fedorchak, you asked for those NSP cases to be held over?
Sure. Those cases have been going on for a number of months, more than a year, a couple years actually. And there's some, I'm having some discussions with staff on some issues. I just want to make sure what we're doing is the best strategic move, and I have some more things I want to think through before I take a stand on that issue of what are we calling it? Intent to close.
You have to realize is significantly different than just closing the hearing or voting on closing the hearing. Intent to close is an opportunity, provides ample opportunity for the company to clarify where they're at after discussions have taken place. But, they're different different avenues that you can take on this type of a case, and you have different perspectives at play. So I'm certainly open to trying to find a clear direction. Is what I want at the end of the day, is to find a really clear direction so we're utilizing staff and our resources in the best possible way, because we are short-staffed right now. And we have a lot, as you heard, through this meeting, we have a lot on the table. So it's an opportunity to seek clarity and to find out has anything changed, rather than assuming that it hasn't. So really, this has been going on since for the last 10 years when you're talking about disputed resources. And it's, is this really a North Dakota problem, or is this something that we as a commission are trying to be cooperative, if you will, and trying to help the company? But ultimately, for me personally, it's about the North Dakota ratepayer. At the end of the day, it's not about the challenges, which I feel for the company, but they do face significant challenges due to some mandates from other states, or another state in particular.
I think I have the same concerns and just see it a little bit differently, that there's been a lot of money and time invested in this proceeding, and a lot of facts have been developed and filed, and I want to make sure that we're using the leverage of this proceeding to get the best possible outcome before we shut that door. And so that's why I've been hesitant to go down the path of closing this proceeding before I have thought through what sort of implications that might have for our staff if we close this proceeding and have unfinished business and no longer have this proceeding with which to process that, in terms of fees and a filing fee that's been provided by the company and the expertise that we have available that are already on board for this. So I want to make sure that I fully understand how we're going to come to resolution on these. If we do shut this one down, how do we get to some of the issues that I feel are important to address long-term with the company?
On the gas plant, can you talk about how you approach a project for siting that's already in existence, or there's already in a facility there? And I think you'll have the same situation with the Bear Creek expansion.
Sure, there isn't. It's not a whole lot different. I mean, the requirements are still the same, and so it's on new land that hasn't been constructed on yet. So you look at that. You look at the expansion and what's there. I mean, there's already been some impacts for sure, and to the area, and visual impacts exist, and there's traffic and all that sort of thing. But the law spells out what the issues are that we need to consider, and we go through those as best we can on every single project, whether there's existing infrastructure there or whether it's greenfield.
I
think, Amy, one of the things with Arrow Bear Den that I think is probably different than probably any of the other ones I remember, where there's an enhancement that brings someone over the threshold or a transition from a gathering line to a transmission line. I thought this one, they actually did not cite the old plant. This is actually a separate facility. The one down by Killdeer, I believe they will be citing it as a combined unit or have requested citing as a combined unit. I think it was more of a general question than about the specific case. Like, especially with pipelines, it's typically more of an issue. One of the things that concerns me, like a pipeline that is to be constructed, our limitation of that can't be within 500 feet of a residence unless there's no reasonable alternative. You know, if they haven't built it yet, well, maybe you could, if it's real close, that could just be fudged over another 10 feet or something to get it more than 500 feet. Once it's in the ground, is it a reasonable alternative to go reconstruct something to move it just a couple feet if it's real close? So I guess when I approach these, I always try to ask questions that helps me gauge whether, and I can't say that I found one of these where it is clear that they built something to get it in place and kind of avoid the first initial thorough siting before they started construction and now just want to transition into what they wanted to do in the first place. I haven't really found one of those that in my heart I felt that was the case. But when it's an existing facility, I do like to ask a lot of questions to help me gauge that. Was there a reason to build what they built that did not require a certificate? And what has changed that now they're doing something different and require a certificate? So that's the way I try to approach them.
My review is as if nothing exists at all, that they're starting from scratch, which obviously, as we're talking about some of these cases, isn't always what is out there. Wild Basin was another project that went from 80 million cubic feet to, I believe they're at 345 million cubic feet. But it does present some challenges in terms of environmental reviews if the expansion is going on a laydown area that occurred during the first phase of construction when they were below the threshold for siting. So that does create a bit of a challenge because it then becomes a moot point. So to say, well, I look at it as if there's nothing on the ground, there's a caveat to that. But that's my approach, though, is if nothing exists and that they're going through everything from top to bottom, which essentially they are.
Do you know when Bear Den 1 was built?
2015, but I'd have to double check.
Yeah, I might be getting it mixed up with the other one.
I thought Pat's it was more recent than that.
I actually put together a spreadsheet to keep track of them all with original capacity. I can give you a copy of that if you'd want with.
And just one final question for me on the one call fines. How do you decide what the appropriate fine is, especially for someone with the repeat offenses?
Well, rely heavily. I personally, you know, I'm speaking for myself, I rely heavily on staff. We have a staff member in particular that works, reviews the case, works with the company, and then makes a recommendation in terms of the amounts that are fined. Now, one thing in terms of staff, and I kind of feel for them because it probably is a bit of a moving target as commissioners have come and gone over the course of time. And you have three different opinions. Maybe we're very much the same in on this. Maybe we're a little different. Maybe we're, you know, significantly different. But then you throw in past commissioners, and one is saying, well, I think it's too high, and another is saying, I think it's too low. And I want to, one thing that I think is really important is that we're not basing fines based on what you hit. Because then it really becomes, were you lucky to not hit anything? If you didn't call in for a ticket, for example, should that fine be any less than someone who doesn't call in a ticket and then eventually or winds up hitting a facility? And to me, they're very much the same. If the risk exists, then the fine should follow the risk factor, because you just, to say, well, you were lucky, so you're not going to be penalized as much. I don't know that that sends the right message to companies in terms of be careful out there, follow the rules. And it's not about, you have damage to a facility and you have associated costs, but the most important element are, you know, relates to the safety of workers and the safety of the public. So I personally would like to be a little more aggressive with that as we go into 2018, but I'm one of three votes.
I want to add something to that, Amy. You know, years ago, the maximum penalty per violation was $5,000. There was a situation where someone was killed, and I don't remember how long ago that was, but the commission came to the legislature and asked for a higher potential penalty. That just didn't seem adequate, and at that time the legislature raised the maximum penalty to $25,000. I've always felt that the legislature set that number, not us, and in response to, I think, the PSC's request that it be something higher than $5,000. And so to me, $25,000 is sort of the guidance that I feel we've been given in the case of the most significant cases, you know, a very serious injury or death or something like that. And so, you know, you kind of, to me, I think we need to kind of start at the top. If we penalize someone who cut a gas line, and yes, a potentially could have been more serious with any gas line, but that affects one customer, and we impose a penalty of $25,000, then that doesn't seem like it really matches a $25,000 penalty in the case of a serious injury or death. So I guess I kind of start at that top mark and gauge them down some. And over the years, I think our staff has received a lot of guidance in what this commission has approved over the years, and they use that to kind of compare and contrast and work with the portfolio holder to and the other commissioners to come up with a number that seems like it fits what we've traditionally done.
Staff exercises a significant amount of patience, particularly when you have a new commissioner. Well, I don't know if I'm technically new. Maybe I'm new until the 20th next Tuesday. That's my 1 year bring donuts anniversary, from what I understand. So, but no, I've had these discussions with staff, and you know, it's a slightly different direction from just, you know, my own comments to them. And of course, you know, they've got a better read probably on Julie and Randy, because they've been around longer. But now it's a new twist for them, so they're very, very good about being open and working on these. I mean, these are, you know, there's a lot of work behind the scenes to go back and forth with the company, to do the investigation, to work with the people that file the complaint, and then get to, you know, come to a conclusion that ultimately we hope positively influences future behavior. That's really what the end result about the money itself, frankly, it could be argued isn't the most significant deterrent. It's the negative PR And we just want them to be safe in the future, ultimately.
The other new twist on this, which you brought up today, Brian, is the repeat offenders. We've had offenders that have offended multiple times in a short period of time, but I don't recall, maybe there are some out there that I'm just forgetting, folks that have gone through the whole process, we've punished them, they've taken their punishment, and then they're coming back again and offending again. And I do think that's an important new category to think through, that we just haven't had that. We haven't had that example yet. And so it does bring up a whole new set of issues that we haven't considered, and staff doesn't have guidance from all of us on that particular matter. So it's good to throw that out on the table and start thinking about it.
Yeah, they know where I'm at on that in terms of being more aggressive with any repeat offender as we go into this new construction season. So not that every excavator in the state is listening into the commission meeting, but hopefully word gets out that if you've had issues in the past that were within your control, whether it's failure to maintain markings, not digging in a careful and prudent manner, not calling in for a ticket, which is perhaps the most egregious, if not the most egregious offense, that they're going to be dealt with appropriately.
Well, I think the good news so far is that the measures we're taking seem to be working, because we don't have a lot of repeat offenders. So that's the goal. People learn, and then they change their ways. And so I think that piece of this whole new area of enforcement seems to be doing a fairly good job of working, being fairly effective.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Better get to a mic.
Use the microphone, Pat.
Questions about the Senex pipeline. It sounds like there's about a mile of pipeline or a mile length that hasn't been surveyed yet. And it sounds like they're up to about 77% on easement acquisition. And then on the Arrow Bearden 1, I don't have a date when that was constructed. It's not in the application. And I don't remember it being asked at the hearing either. So,
okay. Thanks, Pat.
Yep. Okay. We will stand in recess until 11:30 and come back for the administrative portion of the meeting.